Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Kraft Foods v. Cracker Barrel. Mr. Albers.
Good morning. May it please the Court?
Good morning.
The District Court's injunction order below should be reversed for two principal reasons. First, because it's overbroad as a matter of law, and second, because there was an improper and insufficient analysis of likelihood of confusion, both based on error relating to how the analysis was conducted and also clear error on factual review. That the Court has said in the Barbecue Marks case, which we cited in the briefs, means a firm conviction that the District Court made a mistake, and there is such a conviction here. The case is based on Cracker Barrel Old Country Store's use of its mark in grocery stores. It's undisputed that the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store mark and the Kraft Crackle Barrel mark have coexisted for 40 years, and it's undisputed that Cracker Barrel Old Country Stores has used its mark on food in restaurants, in country stores, its affiliated country stores, on the Internet, on social media sites, and it's used it on gift cards in grocery stores for the last 7 years, up to about $100 million a year now in annual sales.
Forgive me for interrupting you, but I have been wondering, do the grocery stores themselves create their advertising circulars without consultation or supervision from the manufacturers of featured products?
I believe the evidence below, based on the testimony of Mr. Pauly, was that we directed how they did their circulars. There was one example where they did a circular where they used Cracker Barrel to advertise the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store hams. But I think the evidence is that we do have control over that and can control that, and we have to approve their advertising.
But you don't control how they, where they, what shelves they put it on.
Do we control the area of the store? Actually, we have to compete for and oftentimes buy shelf space, so we do have a very good idea as to where it's going to go, and that's a good point, Judge Posner, because I think here the evidence is that the meats that would not be sold in the dairy case. They'd be sold in the meat case, which is not adjacent to nor near any dairy products.
Are you saying that cheese products and meat products would never coexist side by side?
I think the evidence from Mr. Pauly below, and this is the only evidence on the point, he was the 30B6 witness for John Morrell, which is a meat company. He said they would, in his experience, they are not sold side by side.
That's not true.
I'm sorry?
That simply is not true.
Well, that's the evidence before the court.
Well, they're frequently sold side by side because people often make a sandwich with meat and cheese.
Well, can I respond to that, Your Honor? What we have here is a rectangular piece of Cracker Barrel. That's how it's sold, the Kraft Cracker Barrel cheese. You cut it off as a snacking cheese. It seems to me, as a matter of common sense, you would not take a little square of Cracker Barrel cheese and put it on a ham and cheese sandwich because it would fall off as soon as you tried to eat it. But the evidence below is they're not sold.
So the issue depends upon the size of the piece of cheese. Since this was filed, I've been paying a little extra attention when I've gone grocery shopping. And I see plenty of meat and cheese side by side in grocery stores.
I think you might see some slices of deli meat next to cheese occasionally. That's a good point, Your Honor. I've paid attention too.
So slices of ham, there would be confusion, but if it's a whole ham, there would not?
There's no evidence that there would be confusion as deli meats. I think as to whole ham, there is no proper admitted evidence that there would be confusion. And, in fact, Your Honor, to answer your question, there were 300 people in Mr. Perrette's survey, that's Kraft's expert, and not one, when they saw the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store marked ham, said Kraft Cracker Barrel, or said Cracker Barrel cheese. Not one.
Mr. Albers, I'd like to go back to the question about scope of the injunction here.
Sure.
At page 13 of your opening brief, you said that the scope of an injunction is a legal conclusion to be reviewed de novo.
Yes.
You cited International Kennel Club at page 1084. Where specifically did we say that?
I'd have to pull the case, Your Honor.
I have it in front of me. Would you like me to read it to you?
I think what we're saying is that the scope of the injunction. The decision to provide an injunction is a factual question.
You were telling us in your brief that we held in Kennel Club that the scope of an injunction is a question of law to be reviewed de novo. The paragraph says, Court of Appeals review of a trial court's grant or denial of a preliminary injunction is limited to the question of whether the court abused its discretion in granting the requested relief. As we discussed in Lawson Products, our analysis of whether the trial judge abused his discretion entails the application of mixed standards. Factual determinations are reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard, while legal conclusions are reviewed de novo, but the ultimate weighing and balancing that makes up the decision whether to issue a preliminary injunction is highly discretionary and is given substantial deference, etc. Where do we hold what you said we hold?
In that case, you found that the court had not abused its discretion in entering the injunction, which I agree to you is reviewed either for clear or abuse of discretion. But you also found that the legal scope of the injunction was overbroad. And you
found that the scope of the injunction was overbroad. Where do we say it's a legal rule that we review de novo? Particularly in light of the fact that we've got the Russian Media Group case, the Harley-Davidson case, that say explicitly this is the kind of thing that we defer to a district judge's judgment about.
I think it's implicit in the decision. If you overrule, that has to be on a legal basis.
What sense does it make?
Well, and what other way? You found that there was no abuse of discretion, but you reversed
it. What sense would it make to have a broader standard of review on this for the scope of the injunction than for whether to enter the injunction?
I think that it makes sense because the scope of the injunction must be consistent with what are the protected rights. And that's the problem here. The protected rights are not as to any food product.
So must the issuance of the injunction. I don't see what the difference is.
I think we're arguing.
You can't issue an injunction that invades people's rights. You can't enjoin people not to make political statements, right? So why should there be a different scope of review for that judgment, whether to issue an injunction, than for how broad or narrow to make it?
The court here only considered.
What sense does it make to make that distinction?
I think my response to that, Your Honor, is I think that a legal decision is different.
What practical sense does it make to have those two standards of review for such similar questions?
I think it's more important to get the law right than with respect to the review on the facts.
It's more important to decide whether or not to issue the injunction than to decide precisely how broad or narrow it should be.
We are arguing both that there should be reversal because of abuse of discretion and de novo review.
No, but you're saying that there's a lower standard of review of the decision whether to issue an injunction than there is about the scope of the injunction.
I have it the other way around.
Make sense of why you think there should be those two standards of review.
In this case, I would say the reason that I would do that is because he only ruled on Ham with respect to issuing an injunction.
I'm talking about your proposition that there are these two standards of review, one for whether to issue an injunction, the other for the scope of the injunction.
I think if you're going for whether there are protected rights, it's important that there be de novo review.
But that's equally the
facts.
Case with regard to the question whether to issue the injunction.
That's fact specific, and the court is clear.
What fact specific? Suppose a court issues an injunction saying you shall not open your mouth for 3 weeks.
I got that injunction from my aunt the other day.
Now, why do you think that review there is abuse of discretion, but a specification of a scope of an injunction is de novo?
I don't know that I can answer the question any other way than I already have, Your Honor.
You haven't answered it at all.
I'm sorry you feel that way, but my answer to that is I believe that if it's a factual issue, this is why I think it makes more practical sense. If it's a factual issue, that's going to be abuse of discretion,
well,
clear
scope
error.
Scope is a factual issue, right? So the scope of this injunction depends on a factual judgment, you know, what kind of juxtaposition of, you know, cheese and ham is going to confuse people.
I think
why is that not factual?
Ultimately, whether the injunction is within the scope of protected rights, our position is a legal issue, not a factual issue.
Okay, we've said time and again that it isn't, in fact, discretionary. But let me shift gears, if I could, to a different topic. It's related. Kraft told the district judge, in essence, that, if I recall from the transcript, that without an injunction, Kraft's Cracker Barrel cheese would wind up essentially being surrounded by other Cracker Barrel branded products in the grocery store. If you go forward with your John Morrell and then with the biscuits and the, you know, the other kinds of products and so on that you've talked about, we're talking here about, in essence, the same channels of distribution, the same advertising, the same kind of newspaper flyers that Judge Rovner was asking about. Why is that an unreasonable conclusion?
Because there's no evidence that those products with that mark would cause confusion with Cracker Barrel.
Do we need to litigate this item by item?
No, and that was subject of briefing, but I think it's their burden of proof, and they have to show that the product, even assuming there was evidence as to ham, that every other product would cause confusion. And
the Trademark Board has a pretty long series of precedents dealing with food products and related food products. There's the Vienna sausage case and the Patrick Cudahy meat case and sausage and cheese, sausage and or canned meats and ham or and soups and so on. But the basic premise seems to be not a rigid rule, but generally, if you're going to be applying the same name to related products sold through the same channels and advertised through the same channels, there's a pretty decent likelihood of confusion. I got to say, that sounds pretty reasonable to me. Why is it not?
Because there's no evidence that meat glazes, jerky, baking mixes, coating mixes, oatmeal, grits, wet and dry gravies would ever be confused where they're found in a grocery store with the Cracker Barrel cheese that is exclusively in the dairy section. That's why.
Well, not confused with the cheese. The question of who the producer is.
And not a single person in the survey was confused.
And if the logo looked the same?
I'm sorry?
Would you make the same argument if the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store logo looked the same, was the same typescript?
Would I argue that there's no confusion? I would. Well,
yes.
There's no evidence with respect to whether that would create confusion.
Of course. I'm asking you a common sense question.
I would say no, because the goods are not related, and there's no evidence that the consumer would believe they came from the same.
Really a terrible argument.
Mr. Albers, Mr. Albers, suppose Kraft decides to open up a line of Cracker Barrel sandwich shops, restaurants for sit-in and carry-out sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Would that be a problem for Cracker Barrel restaurants?
Absolutely, and it's not
Why?
The issue because they're then be infringing on our trademark.
Why?
We're registered for the use of Cracker Barrel Old Country Store in restaurants and related services. They're registered solely for cheese. Mm-hmm. And the court below entered an injunction that said, mm-hmm, we can't sell anything in a grocery store. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate impact of that is anti-competitive in this respect. Mm-hmm. Kraft sells other things under brand.
If they can go into restaurants, if you can go into grocery stores, why can't Kraft go into restaurants?
Because if they're going to be infringing on what we are registered for and what we've been using for 40 years.
Well, they'll have a different logo.
Well, it depends on what the logo looks like, then, Your Honor.
Why isn't it symmetrical, right?
Well, it is.
You go into grocery stores where Kraft is ensconced, but you say they can't go into restaurants where you're ensconced.
They're ensconced in grocery stores for one product, cheese. We're ensconced in restaurants in total restaurant service. It's not the same, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
What's the difference between cheese and restaurant services?
Well, the hypothetical I understood was they were going to sell sandwiches and they were going to sell meals and so on. But if they were just selling cheese, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. We don't sell cheese. And that's the issue. We don't compete. And by the way,
you can't be arguing that there can never be confusion or dilution or what have you unless identical products are being sold by the two.
I'm not arguing that, but it has to be reasonably related such that a consumer would believe they came from the same source, and they have to show there's evidence of likelihood of confusion. And they have not shown that with respect to any product, and even if you accepted it for ham. And as to the ham, Mr. Perret himself in his control group asked, he took a non-marked ham and he asked 100 people, not a single person associated ham with cheese. Meaning, what's the conclusion to draw from that?
They're
not complementary.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Almond.
I do have one question.
Oh, sure.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
Because when you just mentioned Mr. Perret, what's your rationale for deeming the 12-month cutoff used by Mr. Perret arbitrary when your own expert limited his participants to those who had visited a Cracker Barrel store or made a restaurant or made a purchase in the preceding 6 months?
He just arbitrarily chose 12 months, and if he really wanted to test for that, he should have just anyone that had ever visited a C-Box store. That's the rationale.
But your own expert used 6 months. I have a problem with that. I'm wondering what time limitation you think Mr. Porritt should have imposed.
He was testing something different. What we would ask that he impose would have been no limitation. But he didn't correct anyway for pre-existing confusion, which is one of the main points in our brief, which is what they need to test, not existing confusion, because the marks have coexisted for 40 years. So they need to show that if we went into grocery stores now with these other products, that would change the level of confusion. And Mr. Perret's study did not and could not do that. So we ask you to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Allman. So, Ms. Allman?
May it please the Court. As a preliminary matter, Judge Rovner, if you had a question to Mr. Albers as to whether or not retailers are directed as to what to put in their circulars, on June 12th, when Mr. Pauly testified at pages 141 and at pages 151, he did admit that it is very hard to control what the retailers would do, and so the fact that it said Cracker Barrel to announce the ham in the circulars that were put out by the stores that sold it is something that the retailers did, and Mr. Pauly, John Morrell, has stated that they cannot necessarily control that. So you could see that again. So I wanted to clear that up. Another issue I just wanted to clear up quickly is Mr. Perret's survey when he showed hams. He actually showed branded hams both times. He showed a Smithfield ham in the control, and he showed a Cracker Barrel ham in the test cell, not an unbranded ham. As Your Honors know, the district court's decision is entitled to substantial deference, a standard that the appellants never acknowledge. As to the breadth of the injunction in the PepsiCo versus Redmond case, the Seventh Circuit stated that the district court has wide latitude in fashioning appropriate relief and that this court should restrict that injunction only if there is an abuse of discretion.
What is the actual evidentiary record justifying an injunction on Cracker Barrel Old Country Store's sale of all food items? In other words, are there any surveys or findings or likelihood of confusion between, Kraft Cracker Barrel cheese and Cracker Barrel Old Country Store licensed gravy?
Absolutely. There are, Your Honor. And just to step back, the starting point is the Lanham Act. The Lanham Act prohibits the use of any mark on any goods that is likely to cause confusion. It doesn't limit our rights in Kraft to cheese, and it doesn't limit the identical mark. It's any mark likely to cause confusion. With that standard, we then apply the seven factors of Helene Curtis, the factual determinations of likelihood of confusion. The court found the fame of the Cracker Barrel mark. That applies to all products. The court found that the Cracker Barrel logo and the Kraft Cracker Barrel mark are similar. That applies to any food product because John Morrell and Seabox have stated, and it is in the record, that the mark that they will use on all grocery products will be that same logo. So that's the second likelihood of confusion factor found. District Court found that the area and manner of concurrent use causes a likelihood of confusion. That's for all products sold in the same grocery stores to the same consumers.
Well, what if Old Country, what if they just wanted to sell toilet paper in a grocery store?
It's a different case, Your Honor, and maybe the answer is different. But the district court here found, in assessing likelihood of confusion,
Is there any issue about non-food products?
Well, as a preliminary matter, despite what the appellants state, Kraft has never sought an injunction against the use of the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store mark on non-food products. This has only been a food product case, and it has only been a case related to a channel of trade restriction, the grocery store, where Kraft has been exclusive use of Cracker Barrel for 60 years, and the appellants have never been in there. And what we are concerned about is creating what Mr. Pauley from John Morrell said was an unprecedented situation of two companies using essentially the same mark for food products sold through the same stores to the same group of consumers, the general public. But going back, Judge Rovner, to your question, so that we've got three likelihood of confusion factors that apply to all food: fame of the mark, similarity of the mark, area and manner of concurrent use.
Sure.
Sophistication also goes to all food products because these are widely accessible products. And in the AutoZone case, this court has noted that when you have broadly available products sold to the general public, there's not going to be a great deal of sophistication. The likelihood of confusion factors, this court has never held that you have to prove all seven. What this court has said is that the district court can weigh and balance those likelihood of confusion factors that are most relevant and make a determination of fact. So four of them do support all food products.
Well, then what is the basis for your claim that your marketing efforts to promote Kraft's Cracker Barrel brand with a different look, a different tone, a different feel than Cracker Barrel Country Store are irrelevant? Because that's part of the overall impression of the mark, and relevant, it seems to me, to the question of consumer confusion.
That's correct. As we have pointed out in our papers, one of Kraft's main way of advertising is to be in 16,000 stores and to be an iconic brand that's been around for 59 years. There is other advertising. There is media advertising, social media advertising. There is print advertising, and there's television advertising. But not everybody sees it. And the courts have held that when you go into a supermarket, you're looking at the brands. Gwen Gray testified at Docket 63 that when you go into the store, what you're seeing is you're not remembering the commercials. You're looking at the brand and seeing Cracker Barrel in one aisle and Cracker Barrel Old Country Store in virtually every other aisle. So this court in International Kennel Club and in Thai Inc. has admonished that consumers go into stores with not a clear recognition of everything. And so we can't expect consumers to remember what these advertising is. They may remember and hopefully remember that Kraft's award-winning for Cracker Barrel, but what they're remembering is the Cracker Barrel brand.
Yeah, but as you claim, Kraft Barrel cheese has, since the 1950s, I guess, established itself as this award-winning and widely recognized product. How do you justify the claim that entirely dissimilar products like dry goods and gravies sold by Cracker Barrel Old Country Store will confuse consumers? Both ways?
I don't think so. There are two reasons. Relatedness of products is one out of seven likelihood of confusion factors. The Meridian Mutual case made it very clear that you don't even have to find relatedness of products. You can still find a likelihood of confusion when the other confusion factors are supportive. The other reason is the reality of the grocery store. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you would not have thought that a company that makes dog food would also make salsa and would make cookies. But yet Newman's Own makes all of those, as well as frozen products. We've changed as a result of licensing. Licensing has become a far more significant issue in today's grocery store than it ever was. Exhibit 31 to Docket 62 is a circular from a grocery store. And if you look through it, you will see the America's Choice brand on ribs, jello, whipped pudding, butter, cheese. Consumers now see a broad range of products under the same name. If you went into a grocery store and saw Starbucks cookies, and you saw Starbucks gravy, and you saw Starbucks ham, most consumers would say, wow, Starbucks has licensed its mark. If you saw Chobani, which is a major...
Well, how is Kraft... Suppose people do think that that old country store, Cracker Barrel meats are a Kraft brand. How is Kraft hurt?
Well, it is not hurt by loss of sales. I would not get up here and say no one is going to buy ham or gravy and not buy cheese necessarily, although with money tight among consumers, maybe you do make a choice. Maybe you have to figure out where you're going to spend the money, and if you're going to buy a ham, maybe you won't buy it. But I don't think that's not in the record, and I don't push that argument. Trademark infringement is a unique claim because what it does is it hurts the value of the brand. We have a 59-year-old brand that has been the only
so
brand.
So is the notion that these meats are inferior so that people who bought them thinking that it was a Kraft product would be disappointed with Kraft?
It could be the other way as well, Your Honor.
The other way? But if they... If they thought these meats were great, they'd think Kraft was a terrific company.
But in either case, whether they thought the meats were bad and therefore thought Cracker Barrel was bad, or they thought the meats or the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store products were great and they thought Kraft's product was great, all of a sudden Kraft no longer controls it. It's not for no longer does Kraft get to say, this is our brand, this is what we want, this is what we want consumers to think. And that is what a brand owner owns. They own the right to create their own reputation.
So, in other words, what you're saying is that even if it were, you know, if these were Rolls-Royce they could prove that you were selling 10 times the amount of cheese because, you know, it's next to the Rolls-Royce meat and gravies and whatever, still you would be here.
That's right, because as the International Kennel Foods Kennel case says, and Thai Inc., it's the ability to control your brand, to have the ability to say, this is what our brand stands for, and to have somebody say, well, no, your brand's now going to stand for this or for that. That is what is the irreparable harm. It is not a loss of sales. It's the loss of the ability to control.
You also risk laches if you don't fight back, right?
Well, that's great.
In this case, it looks to me like we've had... The water has slowly been warming up in the pot over the last 40 years since the two marks started existing side by side, and sooner or later, one or the other was going to infringe too much on the other's territory.
And there are two latches arguments. If we were forced to wait, as the appellants claim, until every product comes out, then I could assure you that when we got up here to argue about something, we would be told that we waited too long because their products were already in the grocery store. I mean, Kraft acted very quickly when it heard that there was going to be a long list of products being sold, everything from pickles to candied apples to gravy, baking mixes, oatmeal, coating mixes. We came in first. We stopped it at ham, but that's because we moved quickly as we were required to do. As for the latches argument...
You wanted to have a negotiation with Cracker Barrel, didn't you?
Cracker Barrel wanted to have a negotiation with us. Cracker Barrel went to Kraft in 2006. And said, we want to not sell ham. We not sell licensed meat. We want to go into the grocery store with this mark. And what Tom Sampson of Kraft said, and this is in an email that was written by Cracker Barrel Old Country Store, memorializing the conversation. It's Exhibit 16 to Docket 62. Tom Sampson said, if you are going forward with this concept of putting Cracker Barrel Old Country Store on grocery products, you better talk to us.
Yes, exactly. That was my whole point. Talk to us. Now, so you wanted to have a negotiation. What would that negotiation have been? Okay, they talked to you. What were you going to say to them?
They said exactly what they said in that email, which is you better talk to us because there's going to be a conflict
with
Kraft.
What were you going to say to them if they agreed to talk with you?
In truth, Your Honor, I don't know because I wasn't there in 2006.
Well, it sounds as if, you know, you thought there might be room for some deal with them.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. At that point in
Well, it's a very strange way of speaking then, right?
Not
because if you say, well, if you want to go into grocery stores, you better talk to us. That doesn't sound like you can't go into grocery stores. It sounds like, you know, we have an interest and, you know, we'll negotiate, we'll make some sort of deal with you, right?
I would say, number one, Mr. Sampson said this is going to create a problem with Kraft. Number two, at that time, Kraft and Cracker Barrel had a very strong supply relationship. And so you have to look at that email in light of the fact that Kraft was a major vendor of Cracker Barrel. They were a big customer. And so under those circumstances, it would be highly unlikely for somebody who gets a lot of money from Cracker Barrel because they're selling private products to come out with a much more terse email. I think this was an attempt, and there was testimony by Ed Green that they were a big vendor. Mr. Sampson clearly said this is an issue, but he was not so foolhardy as a major company that makes a lot of money.
Evidence about what he meant about better talk to us about this.
The document is just that one document. What I would say is after that, in 2009, 2011, 2012, every time Cracker Barrel Old Country Store considered their licensing initiative, they noted channel conflicts with Kraft, confusion with Kraft, risks of licensing.
What if they put on their product, this is not a Kraft product?
That would still create problems for the following reasons. Number one, consumers don't necessarily look. I know we're not in the Second Circuit, but there have been a significant...
Well, if they don't look, you have no problem. They won't see the Cracker Barrel.
Well, because the size of a disclaimer is usually very small. There are cases in the Second Circuit on perfume copier cases where the Second Circuit has said, no, a disclaimer doesn't work because all it does is, number one, people see what they want to see. Now you have Cracker Barrel, you have Kraft, it could create it.
People see what they want to see. You really mean that?
Yes. And I think if you have Kraft and Cracker Barrel together on a Cracker Barrel Old Country Store product, it does create a greater association. The other problem is retailers...
It says not a Kraft product?
Well, what do you do about the retailers who do not have, who are not controlled by John Morrell or Cracker Barrel Old Country Store? They're not going to fill a circular with a big sentence that says not affiliated.
No, this would be on the package as it comes to the grocery store.
The Cracker Barrel mark will inevitably be larger. Consumers will...
The Cracker Barrel mark is a little tiny thing.
Was the disclaimer discussed at all in the district court?
No. There was never an issue. There was never an offer. There was never any document showing it. The packaging does not have anything. Mm-hmm. Packaging of the ham does say in very small letters, distributed by John Morrell on the back side of a label that comes off the ham.
Okay. Could I just ask one more question?
Yeah, of course.
And that is, given our Sunkist decision from the 1950s, could you, which seems to be in some tension with the district court's decision, could you address how you think we ought to handle Sunkist?
Absolutely. Sunkist states that the scope of trademark rights should be limited to what the trademark owner registered its mark for. That's in Sunkist. That's the premise of the decision. In 1976, in the James Burroughs case, this circuit said trademark rights are not limited to what the trademark owner's prior use was. The Lanham Act states that a trademark owner has the right to stop the use of any mark for any goods if there's a likelihood of confusion. The Helene Curtis case in 1977 says it is well settled that a trademark owner's rights are not limited to what it registered for or used.
So should we say that Sunkist, if we affirm, should we say that Sunkist is overruled or that it's been passed by statutory amendments or what?
I would say that Sunkist, as a preliminary matter, has never been cited in this court or in this circuit since 1976 for the proposition of trademark owners' rights. It was cited in 1983 in a Tennessee case. There is one provision of Sunkist that is still good law, and that is that when there are two plaintiffs, as there were in Sunkist, who were already coexisting, they were sharing the mark, for those two plaintiffs to then go in and say, well, we can coexist without confusion, but the third guy can't, Seventh Circuit said that was hocus pocus. You can't split the mark between two and then say the third guy is out. In that case, Sunkist has been cited affirmatively for that, but it has never been cited again for the scope of trademark rights. It has been bypassed by James Burroughs, Helene Curtis, CAE Engineering, Board of Regents. It has been bypassed by the Lanham Act.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Solomon. Mr. Albers, your time has expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like.
To address your question, Judge Hamilton, the Sunkist case does not stand for that proposition. The Sunkist case has been cited in a 2009 Northern District case and a 2008 Northern District case, specifically with respect to loss of confusion under the Lanham Act. It was cited in the Middle District Tennessee case. It was cited in the Federated Foods case and the Recat case, which are both cited in our briefs, for the same proposition that we cited for, that even though there are products sold together in a supermarket, that does not ipso facto mean that they're related for purposes of loss of confusion. And as to one other point, since I've only got a minute, I think, Judge Posner, you asked Ms. Solomon what if the products were, would people buy instead of Cracker Barrel, would they buy something else? And her response to that is, no, we're not arguing that, and there's no evidence of that. And I think that sounds the death knell for their case. For this reason, you said in the Indianapolis Colts case, 34 Fed 3rd 410, which is cited in our briefs, quote, the legal standard under the Lanham Act has been formulated variously, but the various formulations come down to whether it is likely that the challenge mark, if permitted to be used by the defendant, would cause the plaintiff to lose a substantial number of customers. And the answer to that in this case is no. In fact, what Ms. Salmon omitted to tell you was there's a 2011 study by Kraft itself showing that they're getting a bounce, they're getting a positive effect from the Cracker Barrel Country Store mark. So what you have is a mark limited to cheese that's only been sold for cheese, and now they want to use it because we're going into grocery stores for completely unrelated products to stop us from competing with what? With Kraft's other products that are not branded with Cracker Barrel. We ask you reverse. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Albers. And Ms. Solomon.